As we speak, Joyce Meyer is in the middle of an assembly. You may have seen the headlines. You may have also seen the billboards along the major highways in St. Louis. Joyce Meyer, of course, head of Joyce Meyer Ministries, based in Fenton, has not only been in the news here locally and nationally, but she is also in the news because yesterday, today, and tomorrow, she's holding a national gathering in St. Charles at the Family Center. We're going to be talking here in the first few minutes of Issues Etc. with Bill Smith, a reporter for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. He's also co-author of a series in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch titled Joyce Meyer Ministries, A Special Report. We're going to find out whether or not the recent news may affect the gathering that Joyce Meyer is having there in St. Charles, and we'll get an update on what is the latest in the ongoing saga that is now Joyce Meyer here in St. Louis. Our call-in numbers, I'm Todd Wilkin, by the way, our call-in numbers, if you'd like to join us, are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. That's just the first conversation here on Issues Etc. today. In about 10 minutes, Janice Krause of Concerned Women for America joins us. We're going to talk about the new Zogby poll on the voting trends of women. Single women and married women seem to be the major dividing line in the Zogby poll. And we'll also talk about, what was it, a 48-hour or less than 48-hour marriage between Britney Spears and a high school friend. They got their annulment. They weren't married, I guess, legally. Or maybe they were. We'll find out what this will do and what this indicates about the status of marriage in our pop culture. Then a little later in this hour, Doug Johnson from National Right to Life joins us. We'll get a national pro-life legislation update as well as a review of 2003 on the national scene, 30 years after Roe v. Wade. In the second hour of the program, Pastor George Ontko joins us. We're going to do a little conversation on ministry to homosexuals. He's the ministry coordinator for a St. Louis-based outreach to homosexuals called First Light. That'll be a very interesting conversation. And then, sometime near the end of the program, we hope to have Bob Leko in to talk to us about the Word Faith teaching on the Incarnation, a very odd teaching on God become flesh, Jesus Christ, by those Word Faith teachers. Bob Leko, a former Word Faith pastor, will try to explain it to us. And we've got open lines near the end of the program. Oh, my goodness. What churches won't do to attract people on Sunday mornings. Remember recently the pastor who was willing to pay $5 a head and then $10 a head to attract, I think it was an all-black church. He wanted to attract white people to his church so that his church could look like the kingdom of God. Good intentions, but he was paying people to come to church. Then there was the church that gave away oil changes and free airplane rides to attract people. Now there's a church that has dispensed with the oil change, not just new oil, not just a new filter, a new car, a PT Cruiser, and a Harley-Davidson motorcycle. Raffled it off to attract people to church. The pastor says, and we'll hear from this during open lines, he says, whatever it takes, whatever it takes. Well, here's a question for you. First of all, should churches be giving away cars, if they can afford it, to attract people to church? And if it is truly whatever it takes to get people in the doors, if your church isn't giving away cars or motorcycles and they can afford it, I go to a church that could probably afford to give away a car once every 6 months. It wouldn't hurt them too bad. Does that mean we don't care about the lost? We'll talk about that during open lines, among other things as well. I've also found a very interesting website called The Holy Observer. It's a satirical website. Something very interesting on the purpose-driven life to share with you during open lines from that website. Bill Smith is a reporter for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. He's co-author of this series that appeared recently in the Post, Joyce Meyer Ministries, A Special Report. He joins us for an update on Joyce Meyer Ministries. Bill, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Hi, Todd. Thanks again.
What do you think the effect will be, if any, on the recent coverage of Joyce Meyer here in the St. Louis area, on the gathering that she's having in St. Charles yesterday, today, and tomorrow?
You know, I really don't know about that. I have not been. There was a point that I thought about going out there just to hear what she had to say, particularly what she had to say about the her separation with Larry Rice's TV channel. But I did not do that. I heard a report earlier today from somebody who was out there, but I don't know how accurate it it is that about a quarter of the arena was filled. Normally, she would pull about 8,000 to 10,000 people for one of her events. I don't know what they're doing out there in St. Charles. I don't know how big of a following she's got out there.
Now, you mentioned Larry Rice, KNLC, Channel 24, and a decision that he took very recently. It was in the paper you wrote about it. Tell us how Joyce Meyer came to be dropped from Larry Rice's television channel.
Well, what had happened, and apparently from the way Larry tells it, it goes back to October, back to her women's conference, Joyce's women's conference in St. Louis. And what happened at that point, apparently three homeless women who were staying in one of his shelters had gone out to do some leafleting, basically on behalf of the homeless at the Edward Jones Dome. And while they were there, they were basically told to leave by the security people there that they were not welcome. And when Larry Rice heard about that, I guess he was concerned, but really didn't take any action on it. And then at the point that we did our series, and he learned some things about, I guess, her financial situation that bothered him, he wrote a letter on December the 19th. He said he prayed about it for a long time, and our series ran in November, and it was December 19th that he finally wrote a personal letter to Joyce telling her that he was canceling the her Sunday program and may cancel her weekday programs on the station.
So his basic concern is, I guess, I mean, to put it in simple terms, there is a conflict of image, if you will, between the image that's being portrayed by Joyce and Joyce Meyer Ministries and the image that Larry Rice would like to have portrayed on his television station.
Right, I think that's correct. He says in his letter, and we didn't quote directly from the letter, but I've got a copy of it in front of me. He says in his letter to Joyce, he said that he was unclear as to how you can say that you answer only to Jesus and then spend at least $4 million on five homes for yourself and for your four children, $107,000 on your husband's car, $105,000 for the Crown Line boat dock next to your $500,000 home, plus thousands more spent on French clocks, vases, porcelain cabinets, etc. And basically asked or expected her to reply to explain to him what he felt he didn't understand.
There seems to be two different stories or versions of the story in this respect. Hasn't Joyce Meyer Ministries stated that they were the ones who wanted to cancel airing her broadcast on Rice's TV station?
Right. What in fact happened is, from my understanding, the best understanding I have of what happened was Larry had written to her saying that he was canceling the Sunday program, and I don't know exactly why he decided to cancel that and not at the same time cancel the weekday programs. It could have been a financial reason. He was receiving a lot of money from Joyce Meyer Ministries to go on the air to pay for airtime. When he notified her at that point that he was considering canceling, they got a notification back from her agency saying that they had decided themselves to pull out. So even though he had canceled the Sunday and threatened to cancel the weekdays, it in effect was Joyce Meyer's ministry that had actually canceled the weekday programs, apparently, according to Larry at least, and to some extent according to Joyce's spokesperson.
In addition to the show, Joyce Meyer's show, it appears also that Larry Rice is planning on or has already canceled several other Sunday programs on his TV station. Tell us about that.
Right. I only know that he said that he had canceled, when I last talked to him for this particular story, that he had canceled contracts with Kenneth Copeland and Jesse Duplantis and was considering canceling. He wanted to look and meet with, I guess, his advisors and his board to talk about whether or not he should cancel all so-called prosperity ministers that he was airing. I know he airs Creflo Dollar Show, and I don't know what other programs he airs, but there were several, and he was very concerned about it because he says that the canceling these programs will cost him about $200,000 a year, which is about half of what the station brings in terms of selling airtime.
So this is going to be a sacrifice on his part.
Well, I mean, if you believe Larry, and I guess I don't have any reason not to. He says it's going to be very difficult, and he doesn't know how he's going to make up that money. And he talks about the amount that goes to charity and to and foreign missions and things like that from this money. And he just at this point doesn't know what he's really going to do.
Speaking of charity, and we talked about this a bit before with your co-author of the series, Joyce Meyer Ministries, the last time we talked with her, that special report that you co-authored.
Sure, with Carolyn Tuft, right?
Yeah, and in conversation with Carolyn Tuft, she brought up the fact that after that series aired and there was a claim of what percentage of Joyce Meyer's revenue actually went to charity, there were those in the media, St. Louis media, in certain corners who were claiming that that was an erroneous figure. It was not 9 or 10%. It was more like 90%. Of the revenue that goes to charity. How does that actually come out? What are the facts on that?
Right, it's really unfortunate that that nobody bothered to contact us about that. What happened was when we were doing the story, we wanted to make sure that we had, at least according to the ministry itself, every dollar that they said that they distributed to charitable groups and for charitable works. There were several back and forth emails in which we asked for that information. They were very cooperative, and they sent back another question saying, do you want just the top 10 charities that we do, or do you want all of our charity dollars that we spend? And we said we wanted everything. We wanted every dollar that that you spend on other ministries, on charitable work, and they agreed to that, and they sent us what they said was a complete list, and that's exactly what we printed. We printed no more and no less than what they had supplied to us.
And so that would have accounted for the 9% figure there.
Right. That's exactly right. Since then, they have. I noticed that on their website, they have added what appear to be some other charities on there that they were not counting as charitable contributions at the time when they contacted us. So if there are other charitable amounts out there at the time that we were asking them for the information, they were not giving them to us. So they've added them since then.
Two final questions here, Bill. Any response to the latest article on the withdrawal from Channel 24 of Joyce Meyer's program?
A response from the readers, you mean?
Yes.
Yes. In fact, I received the first what might be considered negative email today. We probably, I would call it a moderate response compared to what we'd gotten before, but in all maybe about 20 responses in the form of phone calls and emails. And other than the one today, everybody was very supportive of Reverend Rice and his decision. And very unlike the after the series on Joyce Meyer, which was fairly evenly split, according to those in her camp and those kind of against what she was doing, this was overwhelmingly supportive of Reverend Rice.
Any planned follow-ups or stories that you're working on right now in this vein?
I'm moving to some other things right now, but if something else comes up along these lines, I certainly would follow it, and we at the paper would be interested in it.
Bill, thank you very much for your time. Keep up the good work.
Okay, thank you very much then.
Bill Smith is a reporter for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. He's co-author of a series on Joyce Meyer Ministries, a special report, and of course his latest on that, I guess a follow-up on kind of the continuing saga here, is Meyer's Ministry Withdrawals Program from Channel 24. It can be read on the St. Louis Post-Dispatch website, stltoday.com. That's stltoday.com. Here in the middle of this hour, we're joined by Janice Krause. She's a senior fellow of the Beverly LeHay Institute for Concerned Women for America. She's joining us from Washington, D.C. We're going to talk to her about two issues. First of all, that Zogby poll. That is tracking the voting trends of Americans and a new, quote-unquote, gender gap that has very little to do with gender. And we'll also talk to her about the latest in the Britney Spears marriage annulment story. Janice, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you, Todd. It's great to be with you.
What is the most important fact that someone should take away from the latest Zogby poll on the politics and the split in America?
Well, the thing that strikes me the most is how influential your religious faith is in politics. we have for a long time been aware that Christians have been involved and have had influence, but we thought of it more in terms of the activists who are in Washington, D.C., who are twisting the arms of politicians. But when it gets right down to it, this poll shows that the people who vote are by and large born again. They are Protestants, they are people who care very deeply about the issues, and they are making a difference at the polls.
The news release on this talks about a gender gap that really isn't about gender, but about married status. Tell us about that.
Well, it was very interesting to me, Todd, because during the election of 2000, the Beverly Lahey Institute that I direct, which is the think tank for Concerned Women for America, did a poll with Zogby and we found, with Worthland, and we found that the Bible study moms, that's what we call them, were similar to the soccer moms, but the women who are Protestant, who are evangelical, who attend Bible studies, were the swing vote in the 2000 election. And, you know, I couldn't help but think of that as I read this newest Zogby poll, because what it shows is that married women, women of faith, have significant influence in those red states, states where President Bush won in the 2000 election.
And what does this tell you about the attitudes of women in America?
Well, it tells me that women who have children, women who have families, women who have settled down and are looking to the future are very concerned about the kind of future that will be out there for their children, for their grandchildren, for future generations. And they know that issues that are kind of lumped under the general category of family values are significantly important. And Zogby points out the demographic and ideological differences between those blue states and red states, and that, for your listeners who aren't familiar with it, refers to the election of 2000, where President Bush won in the red states, and the blue states that were primarily the far eastern and far western states were the Democratic states that presidential candidate Gore won, and discovered that the differences are more than just geographical. We have thought of those differences as being geographical, and we've thought of them as being statewide differences and so forth, but Zogby points out that it's really a precinct-by-precinct difference, that people differ according to whether they dwell in a rural area, whether they are born again, whether they go to church regularly, whether they pray regularly. And I just found it very, very important to discover that people of faith do make a difference, and that their faith makes a difference, because Barna and some others who surveyed evangelical people have come to the conclusion that sometimes our faith doesn't make any difference in the way we live. But Zogby says it sure does make a difference in the way we vote.
Now, I take it then that the difference that is being noted here among women voters in America is not so much whether or not they are married or single, but being married or being single may be indicative of viewpoints, other viewpoints that they hold. They may be single because they don't value marriage or something along those lines, which actually are the influencing factors in the way they vote. Am I reading that correctly?
I think you are, and I think it's a very perceptive reading, Todd, because the gender gap, as you pointed out in your introduction, is not male-female, but whether married or single. And the married itself, I think, is significant, as I mentioned earlier, because I think it changes your perspective to more of the future. What's the future going to be like for my children, my grandchildren, future generations, on down the line? But I think you're very accurate there in that perhaps there's some self-selection that takes place here, that people who choose to be married have values and an ideology, a position politically, and in their thinking that is very different from the people who choose to remain single.
We are just over 10 months out from the 2004 presidential election. What will these gaps that Zogby has detailed in his survey, what will they mean for that presidential election and for the other elections at the federal level?
I read an article today where Zogby did an interview with O'Leary, the group that he had done this, conducted this poll for. And one of the things that he said in that interview really, really struck me. He said the religion aspect of this, these findings blew me away. And I thought, wow, for Zogby to make a statement like that, as many polls as he's done over the years, is pretty significant. Then he went on to say Democrats have to do something about family values, that in order for them to win, they've got to change their philosophy, they've got to change their platform, and accept back people who have been pushed out of their party. And I think that's an important thing for the Democrats to take in mind, and certainly perhaps some of the very awkward and ill-advised comments that Dean has made lately perhaps come from his awareness and from the polling that he has done that shows something of the same thing, that Protestants are a very influential factor in the election. And, of course, we've known that Karl Rove, who's the president's chief political advisor, has been very interested in courting the evangelicals and making sure that the evangelicals stay happy with President Bush. So I think both parties are going to be very aware of family values, very aware that the conservative values of mainstream America is an important element in the upcoming election.
Can we expect to hear more God talk from Democratic presidential candidates?
I think we very definitely will. One of the things that Zogby pointed out is that the Democrats don't have to come over and talk God talk, but they have to kind of neutralize that religious factor in the elections. Well, I think if they're going to do it in the way that Howard Dean made the comments that he made this past week on homosexuality, then they better do just neutralizing rather than try to come over and do God talk, that they are clearly not really talking from heartfelt beliefs and a knowledge of basic theological principles. So if they're going to goof it up, they better steer clear of the God talk and simply try to neutralize the issue. But for those who are people of faith, I think they would be well advised to speak very straightforwardly about their faith. But one of the things that Zogby's poll pointed out is that it makes a difference if you attend church and if you pray regularly. And so that's something that, you know, there is documentation for most of the people at the presidential level of politics, and certainly no amount of talk can cover over the absence at church or the fact that a person doesn't pray. So I think the American voter is going to have to be quite sophisticated in this upcoming election, because certainly talking the talk is going to be pretty popular this election, and so it's going to be important that we look to see if there's sufficient walking of the walk as well.
When we come back from this break, a few more minutes with Janice Krause of Concerned Women for America. When we come back, does a similar potential problem exist for President George W. Bush as he runs for re-election? Can he overdo it on God talk? Should he simply say, look, I'm not theologian in chief, I'm commander in chief? And she was married, and then before you could even practically put the paper down, she wasn't married. Britney Spears in Las Vegas, a big joke? She got married, according to the paper, just for the hell of it. We'll talk about that when we come back with Janice Krause.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Do you know God's will for your daily life? Is God's will a mystery? Do we need to look for a sign from God to know what to do at any given moment? Hi, this is Todd Wilkin. I've written an article in the latest edition of the Issues Etc. Journal titled Locus and Focus, God's Will for Your Daily Life. The recent issue also contains a review of Armageddon, the latest in the Left Behind series, and Aaron Wolf details his spiritual journey to the Reformation from the legalism of evangelicalism. His article is titled A Beggar on the Wittenberg Trail. Plus, you'll find a list of tape and book resources. You can receive the next edition of the Issues Etc. Journal by calling our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172, or write Issues Etc. Journal, Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117.
Now this Global Minute lets you hear what Hindus believe. Let's focus on the meaning of Dharma. Hindus believe the concept of Dharma is the path of righteousness. But when people don't live righteously, they produce bad karma. Dharma implies a sense of duty such as getting married, raising a family, providing for your family's needs. Hindus also believe that anything that helps human beings reach God is Dharma. Dharma is supposed to unite the soul with the supreme reality, and at the same time, it is supposed to suggest a code of conduct. One prominent Hindu writer stated that Dharma is all about nonviolence, truth, and purity of mind and body. Pray that Christians in India and around the world where Hindus live will have the wisdom to explain the problem of sin and the solution of Christ's life. Pray that more Hindus will aim for Jesus Christ in their quest for happiness. Get global prayer news by visiting the website missionvisionnetwork.org. That's missionvisionnetwork.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. I once was talking with a childhood friend who spent most of her adult years struggling with a serious illness. When I asked how she coped, she said it was most helpful to know that others were praying for her. Set as we are in a society that functions only with natural causes and effects, prayer for the sick adds the supernatural, asking the touch of heaven upon scientific medical procedures. God has demonstrated time and again that His way of doing things is to step into our closed system of natural cause and effect. The chief example is the coming of His Son. From the unseen world into ours comes Christ, and from His coming, God's interventions multiply outward. Our prayers for those in need demonstrate our belief that God truly is involved in day-to-day things. People of prayer really do live by faith, not just sight. So to any of you who are sick, facing surgery, undergoing treatments, longing for health, we assure you of our prayers. Life is not just the horizontal dimension of cause and effect that we struggle with day in and day out. Reality is also vertical, and that dimension we invoke for you. I'm Dale Meyer.
Hi, I'm Pastor Doug Nicely. Just before he baptized Jesus in the Jordan River, John the Baptist told those who watched that the Savior would be the one who was filled with the Holy Spirit and with fire. That phrase, filled with the Holy Spirit, is unique to St. Luke in the entire Bible. We'll talk about what St. Luke and the Bible means about being filled with the Spirit this week on In His Steps.
Listen to In His Steps, Saturday at noon with Pastor Doug Nicely on AM 850 KFUO.
Sunday night on Issues Etc., we're going to be talking about Christianity and pop culture with Dr. Mike Horton of the White Horse Inn. That's an interesting conversation with someone. I don't think there are very few today in the church who have the kind of keen perspective and are able to articulate it like Mike can on the issue of pop culture as it impacts the church. That'll be the subject Sunday night, live from 10 to 11 on 91.5 FM here in St. Louis. We're talking with Janice Krause of Concerned Women for America about the new Zogby poll on the voting trends of women. In just a minute, we'll talk about Britney Spears' 24-hour, 48-hour marriage, whatever it was. Before the break, Janice, you had mentioned kind of the minefield that is presented for the Democratic presidential candidates when it comes to God talk. Does a similar minefield exist for President George W. Bush in the next 10 months, given the fact that he was roundly criticized recently for some statements he made of a theological nature by evangelicals here in America?
I don't think there are any serious problems, Todd. I think he does face a theological minefield, for instance, with the federal marriage amendment. There is some dispute amongst evangelicals as to which interpretation of the amendment is most valid, you know, whether it does allow individual states to have same-sex unions and, you know, kind of a counterfeit marriage without calling it marriage or what. And the president is walking a very tightrope there in issues like that because, you know, there are different theological and denominational and ideological positions from the various religious groups that support the president, basically. But I think all in all, the president is a regular churchgoer. He's a man who prays. His faith is obviously very genuine. And I think most evangelicals respect that. And even at the point where there are differences, they respect the fact that his faith is real, that Christ did transform his life, and he's free to freely admits that. And so his God talk has a sense of reality to it. It has a depth to it that I think a lot of evangelicals are very appreciative of. And for the most part, he's done really good things in terms of the decisions and policy positions that he has taken. For instance, his positions on sex trafficking, problem where criminals have taken young girls from underdeveloped countries and brought them into developed countries and made prostitutes of them. The president has taken a very strong stance on that issue and has been very, very firm at the UN and in other arenas that prostitution is inherently harmful to women. And so I think most women, and particularly Christian women, very much respect the fact that he's taken those strong stances. So I don't think he is in any substantive danger at all with what you call the God talk. And I think he can successfully negotiate through those minefields in ways that perhaps the Democratic candidates will find a bit more difficult.
Janice, we're accustomed by now, if we watch the pop culture, to see celebrity marriages that last a year. Most of us are jaded enough that when we see two celebrities wed, or a celebrity wed an unknown, we know it's got a very limited shelf life. One of the shortest was most recently in the news. Britney Spears out in Las Vegas decided to wed a friend from high school. How long did the marriage last?
The latest report I read said 55 hours from the time they actually performed the ceremony till the annulment was official. Brittany is one of the most pathetic characters I think I've seen in pop culture for a long time, Todd. For some reason, she really tugs on my heartstrings. I think in part because I really have a soft spot in my heart for teenagers and the problems that they face during those very pivotal years. But your listeners will recall that she cried during the interview that Diane Sawyer had with her a month or so ago, when Diane asked her about her breakup with Justin. This was a boyfriend of many, many years, Justin Timberlake, who was a rock star of some sort. And he has since gone on and now has a live-in relationship with Cameron Diaz, a movie star. He broke up pretty callously with Brittany after they had sex. And Brittany was, from all accounts in the popular media, she was very heartbroken and felt very betrayed when Justin made their sex life public. She, in fact, took a long leave of absence. She went out of the public eye for months. Wasn't it something like 6 months? After Justin went public by saying that they had had sexual intercourse. When she came back, it seemed to me that she was very haunted and had a hard edge to her that she had not had previously. And then when she broke down in the interview with Diane Sawyer, I thought, my instincts are pretty much on target here, I think, because I've seen it over and over again, and I study this data on a daily basis in the job that I have. These girls have fallen for the myth that sex is no big deal. They've fallen for all of the myths that are out there in the culture that hooking up is just hooking up, and it doesn't mean anything really. But when it comes right down to them, when they give their heart to a guy, they want it to be forever. And I have seen interviews where Brittany's eyes teared up as she said, I really thought Justin and I would be together into old age. So I see a young girl here who fell for some myths, and now she is just literally bouncing off the walls. This marriage out in Las Vegas, to me, is a wake-up call for her parents and for other people who care about her. This girl is in deep trouble, and I think she needs some help from somebody.
I want to go to the phones here in just a second, but I've got to say, it wasn't very long. It was less than 24 hours after the story broke, and it was obvious that this marriage wasn't going to last. There was going to be an annulment. It was going to be over with. It was a joke. But it wasn't very long that people were, in our own jaded way, also saying, you know, she's young, she's foolish, maybe she's heartbroken and misdirected, but she's getting the publicity, and her tour starts pretty soon.
Well, one account that I have seen said, you know, now she's part of the divorced crowd, and this is something that is necessary if you're going to be a diva. I thought, what? Good grief, what does it say about our culture that you have to be divorced? You know, they mentioned J-Lo and some of the other stars who didn't really make it big until they were divorced. And basically saying that this is one of the first hoops you have to jump through for superstardom. Well, of course, Britney, I think, is already a superstar, but she is trying to move up to this next level of being a mature superstar. Isn't it interesting how these people start out like Mary Poppins, and somewhere along the line they feel that in order to be taken seriously, they have to talk dirty, they have to repudiate everything that's clean-cut in their lives.
Let's go to the phones. Chet is calling from East St. Louis. Chet, thank you for waiting, and welcome to the program.
Hello. Blessings, Pastor Ty.
And to you.
Yes. Your guest alluded to some comments made by John Dean regarding homosexuality, and I know it's not quite on the subject at hand, but I just would like for her to enlighten me a bit as to what those comments were, because that's something I'm kind of curious about.
That's a good question, Chet. Thank you very much. You had mentioned Howard Dean's recent comments with regard to religion. What exactly were they, Janice?
To make them very brief and to summarize, he said basically that he was pro-gay because the Bible says that you ought to be defer to those who are left out, and that he believes that Jesus was a prime person who acknowledged people who were in the minority, people who were on the fringes of society. So his faith, he said, caused him to identify with the pro-gay cause and to be pro-gay in his policies and beliefs.
Chet, if you'd like to, and anyone else who's curious, if you'd like to listen to an in-depth interview on that very issue, Howard Dean's comments with James White that aired yesterday on Issues Etc., you can go to our website, kfuo.org, and under the Issues Etc. section, you will find that in-depth interview with James White on Howard Dean's comments there. One final question before we let you go here, Janice. Is the Britney Spears incident a symptom? And if it is a symptom, what is it a symptom of? And is the disease terminal when it comes to marriage?
Well, I think it's a symptom of what is happening with our young women today. They are buying into the myths of our culture that marriage is no big deal. One of the aspects of my job that I find most distressing is that women today are not likely to marry because of the differences in the population of women and men. The marriage rates for women of marriageable age are the lowest they've been in this century. So I think the Britney instance kind of points up that women today don't know exactly what to do. There's so much about our culture that tells them that marriage is not where it's at, that you sleep around. And obviously, Britney was sleeping with this guy. Obviously, they were spending time together in Vegas partying. They, according to most reports, were so drunk that they considered this a joke. And anytime you have a culture looking at marriage as a joke, I think the long-range implications are pretty serious. I think it's a symptom of an underlying problem that we as a culture must address because it's very fundamental to our future as a nation.
Janice Krause, thank you very much again for being our guest on Issues Etc.
It's my pleasure to be with you, Todd.
Janice Krause is a senior fellow of the Beverly LaHaye Institute for Concerned Women for America. She joined us there in those few minutes from Washington, D.C. For the remainder of this hour, we're going to be talking with Doug Johnson. He's legislative director of National Right to Life based in Washington, D.C. We're going to get a little bit of a national pro-life legislation update from 2003, the goals for 2004. We're going to begin our conversation, though, talking about recent comments made by Wesley Clark, a Democratic candidate for president. Doug Johnson joins us here from Washington, D.C. Doug, welcome to Issues, Etc. Doug, welcome.
It's good to be with you, Todd.
Doug, recently, in fact, as of yesterday, Wesley Clark has made several comments about abortion. I would like your reaction to several of them. The first he says, and this is a soundbite, he says, life begins with the mother's decision.
Yes, and he also said that there should be no restrictions until birth. So he seems to be trying to go to the utmost extreme. The other contenders are all straight pro-abortion in the Democratic field, but when the they often put out some kind of verbal smoke screens, for example, on partial birth abortion. Most of them have a formula that although they oppose the bill to ban partial birth abortion, they think there should be certain restrictions on abortion after viability as long as there's a health exception, et cetera, et cetera. Now, if you unravel all of that, it turns out to be total abortion on demand all the way up to birth, too, but at least they feel the need to put out that smokescreen. Clark just dispensed with all that. He said nothing until nothing should apply. There should be no limitation until birth. So at least he said it plain.
He also said, I don't believe people whose ideological agenda is to burn the law or remake the law or reshape it should be appointed, whether they are from either side. I just want good, solid people with judicial temperament. He's talking about judicial appointees here who respect the process of the law we have in America. And he went on to say, I'm not going to be appointing judges who are pro-life. So which is it? Does he not want an ideological agenda? Is that consistent with him saying he's not going to be appointing pro-life judges?
Well, you know, it's interesting. When he was meeting with the editorial board of this paper, the Manchester Union leader, he explained this position that he wanted to appoint people who would respect precedent, which, of course, begs the question on the Supreme Court, because the Supreme Court's the one that creates these doctrines that the lower courts are then supposed to follow. So they create the precedent. But anyway, that was his initial answer, and they said, well, would that allow anybody who was pro-life ever to be appointed? And his answer was, quote, I don't know. It would depend. I don't have litmus tests. I want a guy who will do judicial precedent, unquote. But then the story says he later called the reporter back to clarify, and his clarification was, and I quote, I'm not going to be appointing judges who are pro-life, end of quote. So you can just see the process underway here where one of his handlers took him aside, no doubt, and said, look, you got to be unambiguous here. We're trying to appeal to the real hardcore activists. That's my theory anyway. So he just calls back and says, yeah, well, I'm not going to appoint anybody who's pro-life. So he does have a litmus test. So it was a very interesting interview. I wouldn't make too much of this in the sense, though, of suggesting I would not suggest that Wesley Clark substantively is that different from any of the other eight who are seeking the Democratic nomination, because although they may use slightly different verbal formulas, they are all basically embracing the entire agenda of the National Abortion Rights Action League on these matters, and stripped of the rhetorical smokescreens, it all amounts to abortion on demand throughout all 9 months of pregnancy, no parental notification, No Unborn Victims of Violence Act, and so on and so forth.
And although Clark is more upfront about the no restrictions, choice is choice, period, kind of viewpoint, do the activists who will be voting for the Democratic candidates for president, the pro-choice activists, do they see through the other verbal formulas, the smoke screens, and read between the lines with the other candidates?
Well, I think so, because I think that the groups in Washington that work with Congress on the pro-abortion side, like NARAL and Planned Parenthood and the ACLU, basically have all sent out very clear signals that they think that these Democratic contenders are fine based on their voting records. All three of the senators who are running, for example, voted against the bill to ban partial birth abortions, and Congressman Gephardt, although he voted for it a couple of times, has made it clear he wouldn't do it anymore. He's changed his view. indeed, Gephardt, as you know, early in his career was strongly pro-life, but has now gone completely over to the other pole. So I think that those in the Democratic electorate, the primary electorate in these states who are on the pro-abortion side and care a lot about the issue, look to these groups for their signals and have pretty much been told that these people are all down the line. And that's the way we see it, too. Clark is just expressing it in more stark terms, or perhaps inartful terms. I'm not sure exactly what's going on there.
Doug, give us a recap of 2003 with regard to pro-life legislation.
Well, it was an encouraging year. It was the first year since Roe versus Wade that we had a pro-life president at the same time that we had pro-life leadership in both the House and the Senate. And so, now that didn't mean that we were on easy street by any means, but it did mean we were finally able to make some headway. And, of course, on November 5th of last year, President Bush signed into law the Partial Birth Abortion Ban Act, something that President Clinton had vetoed twice. First ban on any method of abortion since the Roe v. Wade decision in 1973, the first federal ban. Now, so that's a consequence, and we think we have some other opportunities in 2004, which, of course, is the second year of this Congress leading up to the election. But it is still difficult, mainly because the real bottleneck is in the Senate. The House has consistently passed a number of good pro-life bills in recent years, but they have tended to die in the Senate. And even now in the Senate, there is a majority in support of Roe versus Wade. And we've also run into the problem of filibusters or potential filibusters on a number of issues. But even given all that, we have a good fighting chance on a couple of bills, in particular the Unborn Victims of Violence Act, which we've talked about before on your show. We are very hopeful now that the U.S. Senate will be taking that bill up within the next couple of months. This is the bill to recognize the unborn child as a victim when he or she is injured or killed during the commission of a federal crime.
Will the fact that this is an election year, Doug, will that affect perhaps the way the Senate might vote on that particular bill? Because that seems like, at least to my thinking, a bill that would be very easy for someone who's kind of on the fence with the life issue to vote for.
Well, we hope that a number of the senators who are in the middle will see it that way, and they should see it that way. After all, this is an important pro-life issue, but it's not the abortion issue. 28 states already recognize unborn children as crime victims, and that has not impacted on legal abortion. So legally, it's a distinct issue. And I think that some senators who support, regrettably, legal abortion will come to recognize that it is a discrete issue, a separate issue, and will support this bill. But there is adamant, vehement opposition to the bill from Planned Parenthood, National Abortion Rights Action League, and the ACLU, and they are just demanding that senators oppose the bill or be marked down as not really pro-choice, as they would say. And that, regrettably, means that quite a large block of senators will oppose the bill. It may be irrational, but they will do the bidding of these groups just like these presidential contenders are doing the bidding, to whatever extreme. So if we look at the polls, there have been three national polls now on this question of whether the unborn child should be recognized in law when he or she is killed in a crime, and 80% of the public says yes, only 10% says no. And, of course, this issue has been in the public mind a lot this past year because of the murder case of Lacey and Connor Peterson in California. And yet you've got these adamant ideological groups saying that they demand that the unborn child must never be recognized in law, even if it doesn't affect abortion. They simply are objecting in principle, you might say, to any recognition of the unborn child in any area of the law. So it's going to be a very interesting debate in the Senate. I'd have to say that the outcome is in doubt, but we do have a fighting chance to get that bill through the Senate. And if the Senate passes it, the House will certainly pass it as it has done before. And President Bush is eager to sign it, and that would be an enormous pro-life step forward.
How big an issue will abortion be in the presidential election of 2004?
Well, it certainly looks like there's going to be as stark a contrast as you can imagine between the Republican and Democratic nominees. President Bush has been very consistent and strong on the issue, on pro-life legislation, on appointments, on executive actions. And all of the people seeking the Democratic nomination, as we've just discussed, are taking the most extreme pro-abortion position. So it's going to be a very stark contrast. We have certainly seen in the past where that is the case in national elections, that there is a strong advantage for the pro-life candidate, because although the majority of voters cast their votes primarily on other issues, of those who care deeply about the abortion issue, there are far more people on the pro-life side. So when it is an issue that is clearly visible, where the distinction is clearly visible, then we believe that it can be a significant advantage for the pro-life candidate. It has been in the past.
Do you think that pro-life voters, those voters you're talking about for which this is a deciding factor, I count myself as one of them, do you think that they expect President George W. Bush to make abortion an issue for this presidential election?
Well, I'm not quite. You see, it's an issue because of his beliefs, his policies, and his actions. What he said spoke volumes to both sides. The Special Birth Abortion Ban Act on November 5th, for example, it infuriated the groups like NARAL and Planned Parenthood. Anybody can go to their websites and just see the venom that is directed towards the president for signing that one bill. But, of course, that's just one of a long, long list of pro-life things that he's done, some of which don't get a lot of national publicity in the national news media, but which people on both sides who are really paying attention notice. So it'll be an issue, certainly the news media will ensure that it's an issue that's kept in the forefront. We expect that to happen.
Doug Johnson, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues Etc.
Thanks for having me.
Doug Johnson is Legislative Director for National Right to Life, based in Washington, D.C. If you'd like to visit the website for National Right to Life, it's nrlc.org, nrlc.org. When we come back from this break, we're going to spend some time with Pastor George Antko. He's ministry coordinator for a St. Louis-based outreach to homosexuals called First Light. So how do we sort through those who say, I was born this way? Even within the church, we'll find Christians who say, or people who call themselves Christians, saying, I was born this way, and I think I can be a good Jesus-loving Christian and still be a homosexual. What do we do when the first and oldest mainline denomination in the United States consecrates an openly gay bishop? And a lot of people in that church say, well, it's going to happen sooner or later. Let's get with the program. We'll talk about all of that when we come back. Pastor George Antko will be our guest. Ministry to Homosexuals will be our subject. And then open lines for your questions and your comments. We'll be talking about that church that gives away a free car, a brand new shiny PT Cruiser, and a motorcycle to attract people to come to church. Should churches go this far? I mean, they say whatever it takes to get people in the doors, and then when we get them in the doors, we'll tell them what really matters. They come for the PT Cruiser and the motorcycle, but they'll stay for the Jesus. Is that true? Or do you have to keep giving people what it is you use to bring them in? If you bring them in with cars, do you have to keep on giving them cars? Are the other parishioners right in saying, look, Pastor, I've been going to this church for 25 years. Where's my car? Or at least, where's my motorcycle? We'll talk about that during Open Lines, and I'll read a little bit from a satirical website on the purpose-driven life, just for our entertainment. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We'll be talking with Bob Leko. If we can get to this worked in, we'll be talking with Bob Leko on the kind of peculiar view of the Incarnation entertained by the Word Faith teachers. We talked about a few of those Word Faith teachers in the earliest conversation during the first hour of Issues, Etc. We talked with Bill Smith of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch about Copeland, and Joyce Meyer and Jesse Duplantis and others. What are they teaching on the Incarnation about how Jesus became flesh? We'll be right back for the second hour of Issues, Etc. right after this.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172.